Does the law even work? Join me, Grant Shubin, as I explore the question on this episode of The End of the Law. Hello and welcome to The End of the Law, the show that looks at what happens when the extremes of humanity meet the fringes of the law. Every week we'll delve into a current event and challenge the law to prove its relevance in an increasingly confused world. This week, being the first show, I thought that it might make sense to talk a little bit about what the show is, what we're going to talk about, why it matters. We'll then jump into talking about what the hell legally was going on with the NSA's domestic spying programs. Before that, though, I want to give a quick shout-out and congratulations to Radio Free Brooklyn for putting together an amazing Season 2. Tons of great shows are returning. There's a bunch of new shows in the mix. I'm super excited to be a part of the community and hope that you guys dig this show as well as a lot of the other amazing ones happening this season. So, what is the end of the law? Well, the name's intended to invoke two ends, an end in terms of extremes and an end in terms of a conclusion or a finish. On the show, we're going to talk about extremes, the far ends of human behavior. Ridiculous changes in technology and race relations and gender and identity politics, post-Cold War fears of total destruction, terrorism's threat to law and order, extremism's threat to basically everything, unregulated and misunderstood financial systems, all these things have created more ways for humans to do what we do best, take advantage of each other, hurt each other, otherwise treat each other badly. The end of the law wants to look at these situations and sort out whether our communal moral scale, the law, can handle it. The end of the law also means end in terms of a conclusion or a goal. When things are finished or completed, they come to an end. The law should do that. The law should bring about a conclusion of progress. Looking back, it's obvious that humanity has been on a constant march towards betterment. From the Magna Carta to the Enlightenment to the American and French revolutions to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to the International Criminal Court, there's been a slow but very real betterment of the human experience. The common thread through each of these things is that they're laws. The law, in a very real way, tracks our moral progress from feudal times to current times. Each landmark representing a major breakthrough in rights or justice or equality or accountability or betterment or whatever you want to call it. So given all the new ways for humans to treat each other badly, the end of the law looks at whether the law progresses us towards a conclusion or an end, or lets us basically just continue mistreating each other. All right, I know this is lofty, it's really lofty, but I think it matters. I mean, it does matter. The law exists. It's out there in the world, imposing its will on people. And what it does can basically be one of three things. It can either be bad, it can be good, or it can be benign. But shouldn't it be doing good? Shouldn't it punish bad things, ignore or reward good things, and do so blindly? Obviously, it doesn't do that. I'm not under any illusions that it does that, but shouldn't it? So the show is going to look at modern messes and see if the law can handle it. Okay, so I've alluded to the types of things we're going to talk about, but what are they specifically? When I'm not stumbling over a microphone at Radio Free Brooklyn, I'm a human rights lawyer, and that's no doubt going to affect the show. A couple of topics that I think might be interesting are, will anyone be held accountable for ISIS's crimes? Can the U.S. or other countries be held liable for the crimes of Blackwater or Z or other military contractors? Is there anything governing cyber warfare at all? How are gender rights implicated in conflict and post-conflict situations? What are the international standards for elections? And does the U.S. follow them or do other countries follow them? Is the death penalty racist? Honestly, can guns possibly be as legal as they are? And are LGBT people entitled to equal protection, and do they have any rights internationally? Again, these only represent a handful of things that I think might be interesting, but if you think you got something better, shoot me an email, and I'll see if I can turn a show out of it. You can reach me at theendofthelaw@gmail.com. Today we're going to discuss legally whatever was going on with the NSA's domestic spying program. But before we do that, we're going to listen to a quick ditty by Chain of the Gang titled Free Will.
I don't believe in free will.
All right, that was Chain of the Gang with their jam Free Will. And as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about what was going on with the NSA's domestic spying programs today. And I say programs because they are two, a fact that's often overlooked in the media and by the Obama administration and whoever else is talking about it. Both these programs were created in the wake of 9/11 and the emotional and legal hysteria that came afterwards. The first program collects bulk phone records, and the second program collects electronic communications, emails, and other internet-based messages. In some ways, the programs are similar. In other ways, they're really pretty different. And just to be safe, we're going to treat them one at a time, just hopefully to make things as clear as possible. So, the bulk phone records collection program. Just after 9/11, the NSA began collecting, storing, selectively using metadata from American cell phone calls. And the fact that they're Americans is going to be crucial, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but just keep it in mind. Metadata is basically everything about a cell phone call except its contents, its information, like who made the call, where the call went, the date and duration of the call. This information is just automatically stored. If the cops or the NSA or the FBI or the government want to use it, that they reasonably suspect that a particular number is connected to a foreign intelligence target, for example, a terrorist. Once they do that, they're able to collect all the metadata within three hops of that one number. That is, say that I'm the target. If the NSA reasonably shows that my number is 867-5309, they get all the metadata from my phone, as well as anyone I call, anyone that person calls, and anyone that person calls. So let's say I call Tom, and Tom calls Rob, and Rob calls Zoe. Under this program, all the metadata from my phone, from Tom's phone, from Rob's phone, and from Zoe's phone can be used by the government. This program was authorized under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which expands the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. These are things I'm not really going to get into, but I thought I might point them out. Actually, not a lot of people know this, but the Patriot Act is short for the USA Patriot Act, which is actually an acronym, Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act. For my money, somehow hearing it all spelled out like that is more sinister, if that's even possible, but anyway, where were we? Right, so how it works is this. The NSA collects all the metadata from our cell phone calls, the vast majority of which it's not going to use, it just stores away. If the government wants to use this data, it has to write a little memo saying that it reasonably believes a specific number to belong to a foreign intelligence target. And if and when they do that, they can collect all the metadata from that phone number, as well as the data in a chain of three phones connected to that one number. So what about the second program, the Collection of Electronic Communications Program? That program differs from the phone program in that it targets foreign people whose communications overseas flow through American networks. Quote, American networks, from what I understand, are American cables or American satellites, whatever. So if you send an email from Argentina to Canada, it's likely to go through an American network. Though sometimes I understand, even if you send an email from Syria to Yemen or Russia to Belarus, those sometimes still go through American channels. This program is called PRISM, which might be familiar if you've been following Edward Snowden and all of the records that he shed light on. What's important about this program, though, is that its main goal is to collect information from foreigners overseas. Again, that's going to be something we talk about later. In terms of breadth, this program is much narrower than the bulk phone collection program because it doesn't intentionally target Americans. At the same time, however, it's much broader in terms of the type of information it collects. It collects audio and video chats, photographs, cell phones, documents, connection logs, basically anything you might use to communicate over the internet. To get all this information, the NSA has two methods, one of which searches the contents of emails or communications being sent and actually intercepts them from one place going to another. Because the government's flagging the contents of these communications, they have really no way of knowing whether or not that email originated in the United States or whether it was written by an American. And that's going to come up later. In other words, the NSA collection of electronic information doesn't try to collect information about Americans, but sometimes it does. To recap, after 9/11, the government began two spying programs, the bulk phone collection data program that collects, stores, and sometimes uses metadata relating to all our cell phone calls, and the electronic communications program, which the government uses to collect emails, videos, chats, pictures, and everything of the sort from foreign persons in communications overseas. However, because of technical limits, it inadvertently collects some Americans' emails or videos or chats or pictures in that process. With all this in mind, we turn to the real meat and potatoes of the episode, the legal issue. What's remarkable about these programs is that the government doesn't get warrants before it gulps up all this information. I'm sure you're familiar with warrants, but I'm going to spell it out anyway because it bears directly on whether or not these programs are legal. And warrants are basically a legal process to make sure the government doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution when it's doing police work. So, what does the Fourth Amendment say? Well, the Fourth Amendment protects Americans from, quote, unreasonable searches and seizures. Put another way, it prevents the government from going and searching through things that Americans have a, quote, reasonable expectation of privacy in. So basically, warrants are just a tool that courts use to make sure the government doesn't inadvertently meddle in things that we reasonably think are private. To paint a picture, warrants usually look like this. The cops get as much information as they can without actually conducting a search into something that a person reasonably thinks is private. And after getting all that information, the cops take it to a judge, present it all, ask for a warrant for a particular thing or place to be searched. If the judge looks at the information and the alleged crime and thinks that what the cops want to look for is reasonable, a warrant is granted. If not, a warrant is not. Now, before you get all Bonnie and Clyde with it, I'm leaving tons of information out. This is really only a general overview of these things, and there's a whole tortured corpus on what's considered reasonable, most of which I don't know very much about. So don't go thinking this is a get-out-of-jail-free card. But all the same, warrants are kind of like a litmus test. If people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in something, a warrant is needed to search it. If people don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in something, a warrant is not needed to search it. There's only one small wrinkle here, and that's if there's an exception to the warrant requirement in a particular case, but that's going to come up later. Keeping the Fourth Amendment in mind and expectation of privacy in mind and warrants in mind, let's turn to the NSA spying program to see if the governments should be getting warrants before they collect all this data. For the bulk collection of phone records, you might think that who you call, when you call, how long that call lasts is only information between you and who you called. Put another way, you might not think that that information should immediately be available to the government. And you'd be wrong. Under a long line of Supreme Court cases, you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the metadata from your cell phone calls. In Smith versus Maryland, a Supreme Court case from 1979, the cops, without a warrant, had a telephone company install a pen register at its main office to figure out if Smith had called a victim of a robbery. Now, a pen register is basically just like a pre-internet area machine to collect metadata. The Supreme Court determined that the cops didn't need a warrant because Smith didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the information he turned over to third parties. Now, let's be crystal clear here. The third parties the court's talking about is the phone company. This case took place in 1979, back when telephone operators had to connect certain calls and people somewhat frequently had to talk or deal with an operator just to complete a call. Because this was routine, the Supreme Court said that Smith should have realized that he was turning the information over to the phone company, a third party, and that that phone company would record the time information as a matter of course. And really, this is just one in a bunch of cases that generally hold that people do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in information they hold out in public view or to third parties. In Florida v. Riley, for instance, Riley did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of a greenhouse in his backyard because there was a 1 square foot hole in the roof of the greenhouse that the cops could see flying 400 feet up in a helicopter. Because the hole in the roof, it was technically open to public view, so there was no reasonable expectation of privacy of what was in the entire greenhouse. In a similar case, California versus Greenwood, the court decided that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy in trash you put on the curb. Cops can go through that willy-nilly because you're exposing it to the public. So, under Smith v. Maryland and the third-party doctrine, the NSA is not doing anything illegal when it collects all the metadata from our cell phone calls. The NSA does not need a warrant because we shouldn't expect that information to be private. So, what was I talking about earlier with the warrant exception thing? Well, that comes into play with the second NSA program, the collection of electronic information. As I mentioned before, this program is designed to collect audio and video calls, phones, emails, and all sorts of stuff from foreign people's communications taking place overseas. Usually there's no Fourth Amendment problem with that, even though this goes way, way past the metadata into things people have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And there's no Fourth Amendment problem because the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to foreigners overseas. But also, like I mentioned, when the NSA accidentally grabs emails or videos and chats between U.S. persons because of technical limitations, that is a problem because Americans do have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of our communications. This should be illegal because the government's not getting a warrant before it does it. But what if there's an exception to the warrant requirement? What even are exceptions to the warrant requirement? Basically, they're a free pass for the government to dig through something of yours, even though you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. There's, in a lot of cases, they actually make sense. There's an exception for stuff that's just in plain view and the cops happen to see. There's an exception if you're being arrested for cop safety. There's an exception in emergency circumstances if suspects or evidence are going to get away or be destroyed. But none of these really fit nicely into the NSA's spying program, though. I mean, maybe unsurprisingly, maybe kind of upsettingly, the creation of the NSA's domestic spying program corresponds to rumors of a foreign intelligence or national security exception to the warrant requirement. The secret court that deals with all these cases under these programs and another court in Oregon have held that a national security or foreign intelligence exception to the warrant requirement already exists. So under this exception, if the NSA accidentally scoops up and looks at a bunch of my emails or Skypes or videos or photos or whatever, no worries, as long as they did it accidentally while trying to look for other stuff. I mean, in short, both programs get away in the clear. The bulk collection program is legal because we don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the metadata from our cell phone calls. And the gathering of electronic communications is legal because the government is acting in the interest of national security when it accidentally scoops up some Americans' communications. Now, to be fair, legal scholars and judges have raised Fourth Amendment issues with these programs, but as it stands now, these programs are likely perfectly legal. Now, is that right? Is that what we want? Is that what we think the law should do? We're going to talk about that, but we're going to talk about that after we hear this jam by Dramarama, "I've Got Spies."
I know everything.
All right. So, the NSA's domestic spying programs gathering all the metadata from our cell phone calls, as well as certain emails, video chats, connection logs, whatever else, are legal. We don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that information, and even if we did, the government can rummage through our cell phones and online lives anyway, because they're doing it in the interest of national security. Is that okay? We live in scary times. There's no doubt about that. I spent basically all my week glued to the New York Times reading almost everything that they put out on ISIS, the attacks in Paris, in Beirut, in Egypt, in Brussels, and even Al-Qaeda's attack in Mali a couple of days ago. Extremism and the apparent ease of extremists to cause huge and horrible tragedies are constantly in our face and at our fingertips. Without question, we need to protect ourselves from these utter maniacs. But we shouldn't do so by letting the slow ooze of law enforcement occupy our private lives. Obviously, times are changing, and in some ways that's never been more clear than in the rise of extremism. But also changing is the way we communicate. Whereas 40 years ago, it might have been totally expected to come across an old-timey operator when making a long-distance call. But with advancements in technology, we develop different expectations. I don't necessarily think that when I call my grandmother and how long we talk should be something that the government automatically collects. I'm not saying the courts have it wrong, but I'm also definitely not saying that they have it right. More than anything, I'm saying that we need to be aware that what was not private with landlines and pen registers and operators might not track perfectly with what we think is private now or in 20 years or in 50 years. If nothing else, we just need to remain aware of that things change. The law lives and it breathes, and if we don't pay attention, it can choke and it can smother. The law also responds. It responds to current times. It expands and it contracts based on the needs of whomever is goading it to change. In the era of extremism, of the war on terror, of legitimate threats to our safety, the government has goaded the law to favor national security. Again, national security is hugely important. There are literal armies of people that want to destroy each and every one of us. But in a scary era punctuated by sadistic and apparently random attacks on civilians, national security threatens to become an all-encompassing need. It can be used to justify more government insight into our private communications and broader government access to parts of our private lives, and that's its own type of scary. These concerns aside, I chose the NSA spying program to be the topic of the first show for another reason. Next weekend, the program is actually going to be shut down and replaced with a more targeted and focused system. This happened in large part because of the public outcry after Snowden exposed these programs in 2013. I mean, put simply, the technology outpaced the law. The government took advantage of that in secret. And once it came out and into the open, the people demanded change because it didn't match what our concept of community or justice or progress is. And that's what I hope this show can do. The NSA's spying program is hardly alone in being legal and being morally questionable and needing change. Let's uncover these cases. Let's talk about whether they're legal. Let's talk about whether they're not legal. Let's talk about how that makes us feel. And hopefully in this process, we can usher in some kind of change. Now, I've got a couple of minutes left, and that concludes this show. I've got a couple of minutes left, and I'm going to talk briefly about the episode I want to do in 2 weeks, which is about Iraqi and Syrian refugees. Obviously, this is something that's a really hot-button issue right now. It's all over the presidential debates. It's in common discourse. It's everywhere. And what I want to talk about is what a refugee is, what constitutes being a refugee, what has to have happened to you to be a refugee, and when does that status, the special refugee status, go away? If you are a refugee from Syria and you travel to Hungary, and Hungary won't take you as a refugee, so you go to Germany, are you still a refugee if you go from Hungary to Germany? I also want to look at other protections that refugees might get, whether they be under international law or domestic law or various other legal regimes. And in addition to rights, I want to look at obligations. What obligations do countries have to undertake certain, protective measures for refugees? And underpinning all of this, I want to talk about the normative or moral angles to the refugee crisis and whether or not the law actually tracks what we think should happen. Big shout out to Byron Edelman for writing the intro to my show. And be sure to listen to all the great shows of Radio Free Brooklyn this season. Just a few of my favorites that I've heard so far are Shows About Town, Can I Kick It, and Apples and Oranges, which is actually coming up next. I'm Grant Shubin. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is the end of the law, and this is the end of the show. Thanks for listening.